Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great day today, whether you're listening Saturday on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620, or you're listening to the podcast version of this show, wherever you get your podcasts, whenever you want to listen to the show. That's right, you can listen to the show on demand anytime. You can listen to it multiple times if you want to. Just make sure you tell us that you're listening. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at gopensacola@gmail.com. And, you know, just tell us what you think of the show if you get a chance. But we are going to make your day better no matter when you're listening by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on the show, please welcome Jeremy Branch.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. I'm very excited about this first thing that we're going to discuss. I feel like it was a long time coming, Julio.
One might say it was a century in coming because it's going to debut with the, if I'm recalling correctly, the 100th annual Academy Awards.
Interesting. What are we talking about?
That is, they have announced that they are going to add, actually, they've announced in the last couple of years, they were going to eventually be adding two categories to the Academy Awards. So we have a couple years ago, they announced they're adding an award for the best casting. And that comes online, I believe, next year, 2026. I'm not clear if it's the 2026 ceremony or if it's the 2027 ceremony for 2026 films. But so we've got that one coming on. But the one that was just announced in the past week or so is one that a lot of people have been clamoring for a long time. And that some of the other award shows have already been recognizing for a while now. And that is they're adding a category for best stunts. And there's actually like stunt design, I think, is what they're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that, you know, this is something that I think has a number of good things to it. First of all, Achievement in Stunt Design is the actual name for the award.
So obviously, can you talk to me a little bit about what that means to you, or do you have an idea about what best stunt design is?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, it's such a vital part of such a lot of movies. I mean, not that every movie has stunts in it, but, you know, a lot of them do, and a lot of them have, that's such a key point of what the movie is. So,
and they are the few cast members who are literally putting their lives on the line for our entertainment. So, yeah, I do think this is a long time coming in that way, too.
Yeah, and you got to remember that this is not just the performers that are performing these stunts, but the people that coordinate this and put the whole thing together and figure out how to do it safely. And, you know, there's a definite art to all of this. I also think it's an opportunity for recognition for well-made films that aren't necessarily your typical Oscar bait.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Much in the same way that things like special effects have been, and some of the visual effects and that sort of thing, makeup, you know, some of those categories that sometimes we see go to films that would not be typical Oscar bait, whether they are overall deserving of general recognition or not. You know, I kind of, the first thing that just flashed into my mind is a couple of years ago, the makeup and hairstyling award went to the film Suicide Squad.
How could I forget?
The first one, not the good one, not the James Gunn one, the Suicide Squad, but the David Ayer directed and then taken out of his hands and chopped to bits, depending on who you believe. Suicide Squad, one for makeup and hairstyling. And that movie has its flaws. But you cannot deny that the makeup and hairstyling in that film is outstanding.
Iconic, even.
Yeah.
And as somebody who attends conventions, I'm sure you still see the impact that that movie has made on the cosplay community. with Joker, with Harley Quinn. I mean, there's a lot of really iconic design in that movie.
Enchantress,
and the casting was great.
Enchantress obviously had a very detailed makeup, so did El Diablo. You got to think the prosthetics stuff matters as far as that kind of thing concerned too. So Killer Croc, you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those characters had a lot of makeup and prosthetics, and that work was very, very well done. And I think that you can recognize that even if an overall movie isn't the best movie in the world, it may do one or two elements really, really well. Another great example, terrible movie, Norbit. Terrible movie. But the makeup effects in that movie, which were done by the great Rick Baker, obviously fantastic.
Well, to bring it back to the conversation of the two that are getting brought in, you mentioned Suicide Squad just now, which I feel like, as the casting was so good, and that was one of the things they nailed out of the park, that would have been a year where the best casting would have probably come into play, and maybe we could see some of these ensembles win awards like that. And speaking of ensembles, just the fact that they're bringing stunts into the zeitgeist is a good thing. Like, it will inform even people like me who are pretty savvy with the way movies are made but don't know a lot about stunts. Do you think this is going to be an ensemble award? Like, is it going to be given to multiple people? Because it doesn't sound like it's going directly to any one stunt performer, right?
My guess is it's going to go to the coordinator.
Sure.
But I don't know that for sure. You know.
Yeah, we're kind of speculating.
But I think that this is long overdue. You know, it's mm-hmm. such a vital part of so many movies. And it's really interesting. You know, the person that really pushed really hard to get this through is David Leitch, who is the director and producer of The Fall Guy, Bullet Train, Deadpool 2, number of
great
movies.
Movies.
Somebody that started out himself as a stunt performer and coordinator. So,
in The Crow and later in The Matrix, I believe he's been in some really iconic stuff. So I would love to see him like actually do the nominations, or of course Tom Cruise. I mean, that guy is like one of the few that is like known as a stunts guy. So I feel like he'd be a good match for that.
So that's my next question, actually. That I'm glad you brought that name up, because that is something that very much occurred to me. It, depending on how they're going to award this, if they're going to do it to the coordinator or to the performers or however they're going to do it, is this how Tom Cruise finally gets his Oscar?
Interesting.
Because he doesn't have one yet. I don't think he's been nominated more than once or twice.
And we could assume
I
he's
think
probably
it's been,
the
no,
stunts coordinator.
I think it's more than once or twice, because I think he was nominated for, if I'm remembering correctly, for Collateral, for Born on the 4th of July, for...
Jerry Maguire,
for Color of Money.
Oh, wow.
So I think Magnolia. So I think he may have five nominations. I'll have to look that up in the break. But you know, wouldn't it be interesting if, you know, Tom Cruise, who seems bound and determined to eventually kill himself making a Mission Impossible movie, I don't think this guy's going to be happy until he dies on camera, literally.
Unbelievable the stuff that he does.
Yeah. You know, like, I could very much see, we have a new Mission Impossible movie this year. Of course, it won't be, you know, it's going to be still be a couple of years before this award goes into effect. Because they don't do it the first year they announce it. They leave a couple of years to get it into, get everything into gear and build the branch and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because this also means, I'm assuming, that there will be a stunt design branch added to the Academy and a casting branch added to the Academy. And there will be people named to those branches. So that gets these people into the Academy too, which not only... Another thing this does is it changes the body of membership of the Academy.
Yeah, a different kind of diversity, but still one that's equally like representing a wider net when it comes to who is actually deciding what these Best Picture nominations and everything else are.
Yeah, so these folks will get to vote on all of the awards, and it may change the complexion of, you know, who wins Best Picture. You know, you may think that these people are people that work in more populist films. Maybe we're going to see more populist Best Picture winners. We'll have to see. It's going to be interesting to see how this influences things, but very much overdue. We've got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
so hurt today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand, I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we wanted to spend some time talking about the new Apple TV Plus series, The Studio, which Jeremy and I are both watching and both really enjoying, I think it's fair to say. I want to say, first of all, you know, we talked a few weeks ago about how there seems to be this dearth of buzz about streaming series. Like there's just not enough promotion for them. Things are kind of just happening and disappearing, and you're not hearing people talk about them. I have out in the wild heard people talking about this show. Like there is buzz on this show.
I think due to our orbit, it helps with a series like The Studio, which is what we're going to be diving into a little bit. But that's a good thing, right? Was it mostly through fellow film fans, or were you actually seeing marketing for it?
You know, it wasn't even just total. It was people talking about it. It wasn't like so much marketing, although I've seen a little bit of marketing for it. But it was not even necessarily the film fan thing. It was just literally like people walking by and I'd get a snatch of conversation.
Oh, that's
cool. And, you know, and they got the rights to make Kool-Aid. And, you know, like, you know, just like you, if you didn't know what the conversation was about, like if you hadn't watched the show, you wouldn't really know what they were talking about. But having watched the show, you're like, oh, okay. Those people are talking about The Studio. That's awesome.
There is a time when it would have sounded insane that they were trying to get the IP rights to Kool-Aid. But in our current climate, especially with the release of Minecraft, it sounds pretty much spot on. Like I could see a Kool-Aid movie being made in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, let's explain the premise here before we get into the weeds on this show. So this show, as I said, it's on Apple TV Plus. It is being masterminded by Seth Rogen and his producing partner
Evan Goldsman.
Thank you, Seth and Evan. Superbad. Duh. Because that's basically them in that movie. But they, you know, and these guys are responsible for a lot of great stuff out there right now. They are the creative force behind The Boys, which we very much enjoy. Just, you know, doing a lot of interesting stuff. But Seth actually stars in this one. He is a Hollywood executive who, at the beginning of the first episode, gets promoted to become the new head of the studio. And Continental Pictures, am I correct? Is the name of the
Continental Studios?
Studios, the name of the fictional studio in this show. And so it's about him, you know, kind of happening his way into this new job and struggling with the crossroads between art and commerce that is the motion picture business, and how he is somebody who is a film fan but also has to watch the bottom line. And also, so it gets into all of this Hollywood inside baseball stuff, which I love, but it's also sometimes like, you know how like The Office would just get so cringy and it would just get funnier and funnier because it just got more and more uncomfortable. It's got like that sense of humor to it.
Yeah.
To where,
yeah, maybe a little of like the Sorkin walk and talk.
Yeah,
style.
I would say there's some of that in there too. Yeah, but I mean, just really well done. And it's these episodes that are, I guess, a little longer than a half an hour each, but man, they feel like there's so much, they pack so much into an episode. They like, I didn't even realize it was only a half an hour show until I sat down and binged the last couple, because I felt like I was watching an hour of show, not in a bad way, in a good way. Like there's so much in there and you're so absorbed in it, you don't really get the feeling of what the passage of time is. Does that make sense?
Right. No, for sure. For sure. And there is rounding out the cast.
Yeah. There's a core ensemble here. That's exactly where I was going with this, which is, his kind of right-hand man, his best friend, who was a fellow executive. They were both competing for the job. And of course Seth got it, but this guy's still his friend. It doesn't really seem to be like machinating against him or anything. He seems like he's really supportive of him. But Ike Barinholtz, great actor.
Is he underrated, would you say, or is he rated appropriately?
You mean the character or the actor?
The actor.
Oh. So
Ike Barinholtz as a comedic presence in movies and television.
I think still underrated. You don't really see him getting leads yet, and I think he probably could hold a lead somewhere.
He's really funny. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. So you've got your head of the marketing department, who is the amazing Catherine Hahn.
So funny, man. Just what a great character.
Always love her. And then you have his assistant, who he promotes to a creative executive position once he is promoted. And I had forgotten the actress's name, but she's just fantastic.
Her name is Chase Sue Wonders.
Thank you.
She looks familiar to me, but I don't know what from. Apparently she was in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then the former head of the studio, who was his mentor, who he then, you know, needs help from and has to end up bringing her in on a producer deal, so she ends up showing up in every episode too, is Catherine O'Hara, the great Catherine O'Hara.
Who, one of the comedic heavy hitters of our day. I mean, just all the way back to the beginning of her career, she's just in one great project after another. And we were going to talk a little bit more about Catherine O'Hara as the show progresses, but man, she's just always so good. So yeah, it's a really fun cast. And as you said, that kind of rounds out the ensemble
And they're not all in every episode. They, you know, the only one that's in every, only ones that are in every episode so far are Seth Rogen and Ike Barinholtz.
We have the head, the CEO of Continental, played by Bryan Cranston, who is hilarious in that role.
Yeah, I'm interested to see if he's going to show. I'm assuming he's going to show up again at some point. He's not part of the regular ensemble. It was a guest part.
Right.
But yeah, he is fantastic. He's like the head of the multinational conglomerate that runs the whole thing. And he's very much a commerce guy. He could care less about the art. He is.
Yeah.
He is. I'm going to say it. You know what I'm going to say.
Oh, yeah.
He's the David Zaslav character.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's interesting because, like, that's a good place to start talking here. Well, before I get into that, real quick, they round this out with every episode has a ton of guest stars in it. And it is very much verisimilitude. You have a number of directors playing themselves, some of whom are not really actors, but they're great at playing themselves. Some of whom have a history of as actors, and you know that works even better, I think.
Yeah.
But you have a number of actors appearing as themselves too, and you know, so it very much feels, you know, they talk about real movies and they cite different things, and you know, it's very much in that community, even though there's a fictional studio. To the extent that the first episode literally had Charlize Theron in it to deliver one line.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was kind of brilliant in and of itself. Yeah, you get this major star in there and she's there for one line.
The opening sequence of episode one with Paul Dano in that kind of mobster movie is so funny and just such a great introduction to like the tone of what the show is going to be. Before we do switch, one just quick question. Is it too inside baseball for your casual audience?
I don't think so, because I think they do a good job of I think if you watch movies at all, if you follow movie news at all, and I think that's the target audience for this kind of thing, you know who a lot of these names are. There were one or two places where I was like, is that a real guy? And then I went and looked him up and it was a real guy. It was, there was one of the directors who was very much a young, up and coming director who I turned out to find out when I looked him up is actually the son of Kevin Klein and Phoebe Cates.
Is it Nicholas Stoller?
No, it's his name was Klein. I can't remember the first name, but
Owen Klein.
Yeah, Owen Klein. Yeah, he is actually a real director and is actually in real life the son of Kevin Klein and Phoebe Cates.
That's wild.
And has done a little acting over the course of his career as well. But yeah, I think they do enough to intro or say who these people are. You know, when they brought in the director of Smile, they mentioned that movie more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have people that are more iconic like Martin Scorsese and Ron Howard.
Yeah.
Who both have acting experience, but who are both playing themselves in this and both just outstanding. Just like, I mean, like, this show is going to be a minefield for the Emmy category for best guest appearance.
Oh, yeah, good point.
For sure, for sure, for sure. But I kind of wonder if the fact that you've got Seth Rogen at the core of the show isn't what's letting them draw all these people. Like, he's obviously been in Hollywood a long time. He's made a lot of friends and a lot of relationships. And I wonder if that's allowing him to draw all of these people in to appear on the show. I have to imagine that's what's happening.
It's got to play a factor. And then I think also Apple has done a good job of cultivating goodwill with more prestige actors and filmmakers, and even allowed Killers of the Flower Moon to be made by Scorsese, and that got its theatrical release. So, like, I think they're doing a good job of building relationships by not being afraid to just kind of throw the bands at the performers and the cast and crew. So it seems to be working out well for them.
Yeah, I think that assuming this show is catching on the way it seems to be catching on, and assuming we're going to get more than one season of this, I think this is going to become the kind of show that people are clamoring to make an appearance in.
Mm-hmm.
And which is only going to benefit this show in the long term. Really, really enjoying this. We're going to get a little bit more into the weeds on this when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We have Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we are talking about The Studio, the new series on Apple TV Plus that Jeremy and I are both really enjoying. And if you haven't checked this show out, make sure you get on there and check it out. It's there's five episodes in so far? Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right? Six one will drop on Wednesday, so you've got a little bit of time to catch up. The episodes, like I said, are not super long. They'll feel like you'll feel like you've absorbed a lot in each episode, but they're not very long. I'm coming in with the music that I'm coming in with, just so you know. Last segment, you can't always get what you want. This one, if you could read my mind, because these are songs that actually play important roles in the show too. Both of them are kind of plot points in various episodes. So we talked a little bit about this. I kind of want to go through a little bit through each episode. So the first episode, as we mentioned, Seth Rogen's character gets elevated to the head of the studio, in part because he agrees immediately with the overall boss of the company that making a Kool-Aid movie is a priority. They've got, because they're trying to find their Barbie. and it's going to be Kool-Aid. That's going to be the thing. So, you know, he immediately goes into work in that he wants to make a Kool-Aid movie, but for it to be elevated in the same way that Barbie was elevated.
And the key to Barbie's success was that it had a real director. It had Greta Gerwig. She had a vision. So he's got to go out and find the filmmaker that's going to pair perfectly with the material to elevate it to something greater than just a corporate product.
Yeah. So they meet with this director who's got a take on it. And he's kind of like a, you know, a good, like, solid family film, middle of the road director. And that's not good enough for Seth Rogen's character. I can't believe the name of his character has just gone out of my head. But
Matt,
thank you. But then he, Matt takes a meeting with Martin Scorsese, to potentially work on his next project.
Played by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Played of course by himself. Yeah. Pretty much if we mention a real person in this, they're playing themselves.
Yeah.
So Scorsese tells him that the movie that he's wanted to make his entire career, that's going to be his next film, is about the Jonestown Massacre. So the light bulb goes up over Seth Rogen's head. If you know about the Jim Jones and the Jonestown Massacre and what happened there, is all that's where the phrase drinking the Kool-Aid comes from.
Right. It's, they might not even be familiar with the Jonestown Massacre, but they've heard drinking the Kool-Aid, and that is where the reference comes from.
And it's explained in the show as well. So if you didn't know about it, it's there. But, you know, of course, this was this tragedy where this cult leader, Jim Jones, tricked all of his followers into drinking poison. And they mentioned this in the show, too. This is important. It wasn't actually Kool-Aid. It was Flavor-Aid. they do mention it in the show, but that's, you know, it's become synonymous. And so light bulb goes off over Matt's head. This is my end. We call this movie Kool-Aid. I'm satisfying the art side. I'm satisfying the creative side. Everybody's happy. Everybody wins. They're going to go out in the trades and make the announcement that Martin Scorsese is directing Kool-Aid. And then, you know, they realize, wait, we can't do that. We can't associate Kool-Aid with, you know, this license that we're trying to get with
a mass unaliving.
Yeah. Yeah. So it turns out in order to keep his job, he has to tell the studio boss that he bought this, he spent $4 million on this screenplay just to kill it, to protect their Kool-Aid movie.
Yeah. And which is a genius move as far as he's concerned.
Yeah. The executive thinks it's amazing. Scorsese, meanwhile, is crushed.
Yeah.
And Matt ends up finding out from Steve Buscemi, who was going to be playing Jim Jones in the film, that Scorsese planned for it to be his last film. Like, that was it. This was going to be the capper on his long and storied career.
Yeah.
And it's just this gut punch. And they get thrown out of Charlize Theron's party because they've broken Martin Scorsese's heart. And it's so cringe, but it's so funny. Oh my God. Yeah. It is just painful.
I feel like if you've watched episode one, you're going to know right off the bat if you're into that style or not. And when I say inside baseball, referring to the kind of broader audience out there, I feel like it's fair to say if you're listening to us right now, the show is kind of made for you. So I really strongly recommend if, like, you even have a kind of fleeting interest in what Seth Rogen's up to and you're into movies, this is like a perfect pairing.
Well, and I mean, I think that's even more true. Like, I feel like the episode that's the most inside baseball is the one that also, like, kind of locks it in. And that's the second episode, which is titled The Oneer. If you know what a oneer is, it's a long extended sequence of a film or TV show that is all done in one take.
Cinephiles would say it's like the highest achievement of filmmaking, and average audiences might not even notice that it's happening.
Yeah.
But it's essentially just one long continuous shot without any edits or any cuts in it.
Whether it was actually whether it was actually done that way or it has been faked up to look like it has been done that. Like like the entire movie Birdman is allegedly one take, but it's not. That was edited.
Same with 1917.
Creative. Those movies were creatively edited. But like, name a couple of like the big sequences that you could think of that were oneers.
Of course, the back tour through the kitchen into the dining room at the restaurant in Goodfellas, I think, is a really good point to example.
Yeah, or in Boogie Nights, the when they're going through the house. Mm-hmm. At the big party at the beginning, that one's one. So yeah, so like I said, this long unbroken, or appearing to be one unbroken, one take shot. So,
and we have a whole 30-plus minute episode here that not only covers it but emulates the style pretty seamlessly throughout.
Yeah, so the episode is about him wanting to be on set when the director Sarah Polley is shooting what he believes is going to be an iconic oneer that people mm-hmm. are going to talk about for ages. And he wants to be there and be a part of that magic. Of course, when you have the studio head on the set, everything goes to hell because everybody's trying to defer to the studio head. And uh-huh. at the same time, he's bumbling through everything and is managing to ruin this shot that they've only got a couple of opportunities to get before they lose the light.
Uh-huh.
And it's all these machinations of the director doesn't want to tell him off because she's trying to get $800,000 out of him so she can get the Rolling Stones "You Can't Always Get What You Want" for that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the actress who's trying to kiss the lead actress, who's Greta Lee playing herself, trying to kiss up to him because she wants to use the corporate jet for the press tour. So people are not focusing on what they would normally be focusing on because they're trying to, you know, for one way or another, either get him out of the way or get closer to him.
Mm-hmm.
The brilliance of this episode is not just that this inside baseball of talking about the oneer, it's that the entire episode is done as a oneer.
And it's really impressive when you consider that they start out in a vehicle in one location, and then they end up in a second location. And at the end of the episode is kind of a callback, which is another kind of key point in it.
It's a bookend.
They're driving away.
It's a bookend. Everybody loves a bookend.
A bookend. That's right. Which
is also a point of contention in the movie, yeah. With something that he suggests for the film. So, yeah, I mean, it's so metatextual. The fact that they've got this episode about doing a oneer, and they've done the episode as a oneer, they've got all these little things that they do in the episode. And I think that that's something that is a recurring theme in this show, not just in this episode. I think this episode is the most obvious example of that. But there's so many other places within this series that they do things like this.
Mm-hmm.
That they put this, the what they're talking about in the episode, they actually do in the episode. The other great example is there's an episode where they're working with Ron Howard on a movie, and he's directed, you know, this movie that apparently is going to be an all-time classic if it ended at 2 hours, but there's another 45 minute segment on the end of it that has no business being in there. That is this complete self-indulgent thing, but it means a lot to Ron Howard. Doesn't mean anything to anybody else, but everybody's afraid to tell him. And it's set to the Gordon Lightfoot song, "If You Could Read My Mind." And everybody's trying to wrestle with how they're going to tell him this. And it ends up really badly. And then it ends up with that same song playing over Matt doing the same things from that sequence, kind of this introspective. Yeah. And it's just, it's so good. And Ron Howard himself is so good in that episode. You forget what a good actor he is. He's just so great in it. We got to take a break. We'll be back with Warman in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Thank you.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we are discussing the new Apple TV Plus series, The Studio, series that we're very much enjoying, and hopefully we're talking you into very much checking out if you haven't checked out yet, or you know, maybe you're enjoying it just as much as we are. Hopefully you are. If you haven't, of course, you could always drop us a line, tell us what you think of the show or what you think of this show for that matter at gopensacola@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you and find out what you think of the studio or anything else we're talking about, or if you just wish we'd shut the hell up.
Yeah. No. Keep that note.
don't be afraid to give me the note. Just because you gave me a stupid note about A Beautiful Mind. Again, this gets into the third episode of the studio, which we talked about briefly, but this episode where Ron Howard has to be given this note to cut out this very personal sequence of this film. The reason that Matt, Seth Rogen's character, is so reluctant to give him the note is because when he was first starting out in the business, he had been invited to a very intimate screening of A Beautiful Mind, and Ron Howard was asking for feedback, and he gave some really, really stupid feedback that I actually won't mention on the air, because if you haven't seen A Beautiful Mind, it is a little bit of a spoiler for A Beautiful Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny because they play on, everybody knows Ron Howard has a reputation for being a very nice guy. You know, he's a brilliant director, but also has this great reputation for being one of the nicest guys in Hollywood. And you see Matt say that he's heard that that's not true. And, you know, there's some people that say, comes out that, of course, when he gave this stupid note, that Ron Howard just went to town on him. And when he finally does have to give the note in front of everybody, he's about to give the note, and Ron Howard said, "Oh, you're going to give me a note?" And he thinks maybe Ron Howard doesn't remember him, and he's been trying to play like Ron Howard doesn't remember him. And Ron Howard reveals, "Oh yeah, he remembers him." And just rips into him. And they get into this brutal fight, like almost getting physical.
Uh-huh.
It's so contrary to Ron Howard's type, but he plays it so well. He's so good in this. Like it's kind of a shame the guy doesn't act regularly anymore.
It's such a funny series because it also gets really into, and you mentioned it in The Oneer as well, where like everybody's got their agenda, but then they've also got their ulterior motives, and nobody's willing to give Ron this note that everybody universally thinks like the end of this movie sucks, and anytime it comes up in conversation they completely bail out and don't take the opportunity to tell him, because maybe they want to have a working relationship with him, or they just want to be liked by him and all of that kind of stuff. So one of the things that I like about this series, and it's just something that is like a recurring theme, is that there are so many driving motivations behind each different person in a cast that all kind of are, they're all kind of in business for themselves. And then ultimately everybody comes together to like make this cohesive project, and that also carries over into episode 4, which is called The Missing Reel. This one is kind of a neo-noir set one. Go ahead.
Yeah, before we jump into that, I just want to mention too, in the note episode, Anthony Mackie plays the star of Ron Howard's film, and he is just so good in this too.
So good. Yeah, just, absolutely.
Just, you know, like you forget what a good actor Anthony Mackie is. But in this piece, playing a version of himself, he just kills it, man. But yeah, the fourth episode, it's very much, and they, again, they're not afraid to just overtly say these things in the course of the episodes. It's very much a parody of Chinatown and other like neo-noir films. It leans into all of the noir tropes. You know, Matt ends up in a hat and a trench coat, and he's giving narration because his therapist told him he should record voice memos. So he's recording these voice memos on his iPhone that serve as this, you know, omniscient narration when they're investigating that they're making this film and it's being shot on film. He's given the director, Olivia Wilde, the freedom to shoot on film, which almost nobody does anymore. And a reel of the film has gone missing. And he's worried that he's going to be the person that killed film because this is going to be the argument for we shouldn't be doing things on film. Everything should just be digital.
So they
go on this investigation trying to find this film before the shoot wraps and they lose their cast and they can't get him back for reshoots. And, you know, they're investigating all these people and, he finds out that Zac Efron, who's the star of this film, hasn't been getting along with Olivia Wilde. And he starts to accuse Zac Efron of it. And it turns out Zac Efron just doesn't like him because he thinks he's cheap.
Because he wouldn't throw him a rap party.
Yeah.
Funny stuff.
It plays so well. And, again, Olivia Wilde playing herself and another director who, came up as an actor. So, again, not so hard a stretch that she's unable to, she's obviously a good performer. And apparently one of the notes that he'd given her is that she should do a cameo in the film. Again, that's kind of a noir trope too, going back to Orson Welles and, to Hitchcock and, that sort of thing. And the reel that she has, I don't want to spoil anything, but the reel that's been lost, it contains this big stunt sequence and also contains her cameo. And everybody is saying that her cameo is some of the best acting she's ever done in her career. That, even though it's a small, very small part, she could even get an Oscar nomination for this cameo. And so it's this big hunt for who's done it. And, if you've seen Chinatown or if you're vaguely familiar with Chinatown, you know that the big climax of the film ends with this iconic line. I'm saying, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally call back to that line in the climax of this episode where he says, forget it, it's Chinatown. It's just a ripoff of Chinatown.
Because the movie that they're shooting is also a noir, which kind of ties into like With the Wonder, where like the theme of the show or the particular episode is reflecting what's going on whatever the project that they're working on is. And what I like about this with Martin Scorsese, Olivia Wilde, and now Ron Howard, all of the cameos, they're playing their own name, but they're not afraid to do this almost like heightened version of themselves and one that's not always viewed in a super favorable light. And I like that. I think it's fun that Olivia Wilde is willing to play a jerk in the series, where to the point where like other cast members are complaining about the way that she's a tyrant on set.
Especially after the stories that came out of Don't Worry, Darling.
I was about to say the same because she does have, and probably unfounded. I say, show me a set where everybody's perfectly composed all the time, and I will show you something that ends up probably not being a movie that the cast and crew were passionate about. I mean, even in terms of more recently, Jason Momoa caught some heat for the set of Minecraft. And it's like, just because somebody gets frustrated, I don't think we should say that they're like difficult to work with or like a problem, because as you can see in this series, and as anybody that's ever been on a set can attest to, tensions run high when you're up against the clock,
Yeah. Yeah. Which is understandable. Things like that happen, but, I don't know. I think there can be harmonious sets and still be great movies, but yeah, there can also be sets that seem to be harmonious. Then you find out later they weren't as harmonious as they seem to be. So,
yeah,
you never know. The most recent episode, which Jeremy, I know you haven't seen yet, so I won't go into great detail on, is called The War.
Mm-hmm.
And, this one is kind of a, Matt's very much just a supporting character in this one. He's not in this episode this much. It's kind of a Seth Rogen light episode, but this is the one where Ike Barinholtz and Chase Sue Wonders get a chance to really shine, because this is about the two of them competing for to get a leg up at the studio, to get a leg up with Matt, to get their own two features that they're working on that are competing features made. And it is very much a Bugs Bunny versus Daffy Duck Warner Brothers cartoon of an episode.
And it's about a slasher film, or they're working on a slasher film.
Yeah,
right?
each one of them is trying to make a low budget horror film.
Oh, that's fun.
And Ike Barinholtz's film is called Wink. It is very much a ripoff of Smile, but he's managed to induce the actual director of Smile to come in and potentially rip off his own film.
Oh,
which,
that's fun.
Which he, you know, he says, I've already done two of these. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and that director plays himself, Parker, what is his last name?
Parker Finn.
Parker Finn. Yeah. Meanwhile, Chase Who Wonders wants to give an opportunity to this young indie director, who we mentioned earlier, Owen Klein, who's done some interesting work and had a film debut at Cannes and, you know, thinks this is his next leg up. And she has an idea for this, you know, it's going to be low budget, but it'll be a little more elevated. And the two of them are fighting, and it's about the younger executive versus the older executive. And it, like I said, it turns into straight up Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, like literal. It's just so funny. This series is so good, and I hope you check it out. We've got to run, but we'll be back next week with more. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.